This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The number of heavy drug abusers in this country is estimated at 5.5 billion and rising. My guest, Mathea Falco, is trying to figure out what to do about that. She's a drug policy analyst who was an advisor to Bill Clinton during his presidential campaign. She also served as Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics Matters under President Jimmy Carter. She's the author of a new book about drug programs that work, The Making of a Drug-Free America. Falco thinks we need to take a new look at our national drug policy.
Since 1981, we have spent more than $100 billion tax dollars trying to control the supply of drugs, trying to reduce the availability of heroin and cocaine coming into the country. And in fact, now those drugs are more available at cheaper prices than ever before. So I think a lot of people look around and see a lot of drug addiction, increasing drug crime, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars being spent, and yet where's the progress? So no wonder they feel discouraged.
Well, what is the good news about drugs?
Well, the good news is that in the past decade, there has been a substantial amount of research that shows we really can reduce the demand for drugs, and that if we begin to focus on prevention, education, treatment, community organization, community policing, efforts right here at home, in our own towns, in our own homes and schools, we really can make an impact both on drug abuse and drug crime.
What would you say then has been wrong with the policy which the Clinton-Gore administration has inherited from the Bush administration, which does focus on interdiction and on the punishment of drug dealers? Should any of that policy be maintained to deal with the problems of the 90s?
Marty, I think we have to take a very hard look at drug policies. Right now, in a $13 billion national drug budget, we are spending almost as much on foreign drug eradication and interdiction programs as on all prevention, education, and treatment combined. That gives you a sense of where the priorities are. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, he immediately put 80% of federal drug dollars into trying to cut off the supplies, and only 20% into prevention and treatment. This resulted in substantial cuts in treatment and prevention, which we're still living with today. For example, fewer than 20% of the nation's drug addicts can get treatment unless they can afford to pay for it. We all see the consequences of that in terms of street crime, homelessness, drug addicts using the public emergency rooms in hospitals because there are no treatment programs. We're all paying for this problem in many, many ways.
Let's talk a little bit about drug treatment programs, and they seem to have had a more fairly checkered results. If you look at some statistics, it shows that drug treatment is not always a solution to a drug problem. What are some of the hallmarks of effective drug treatment programs?
The best programs, Marty, are rigorous, intensive, and they tend to last at least a year, whether that's in the direct participation in the program or through some follow-on activity. The one unifying factor about success in drug treatment is that length of time in treatment is directly related to success. And they have found that for those people who can stick with drug treatment for a year or longer, the success rate is 3 out of 4, which is really very impressive.
Many people drop in and drop out of drug treatment programs. Does that mean that the programs are a failure?
Oh, not at all. In fact, we have to start thinking of the treatment process as one which will inevitably involve several efforts before success. I mean, let's again talk about cigarette smoking. The average successful quitter, the person who finally walks away from cigarettes, has relapsed 4 times. That is, gone back to smoking after 4 quitting attempts before finally giving up. But yet we don't think of that as hopeless. I mean, people don't say, "Ugh, well, you can't ever give up smoking because looks, you know, the average quitting, you know, has to go through 4 series. But we've tended for historical reasons to think about drug abuse treatment very differently. We tend to think about it as something a little bit like driving your car to the shop and getting a new carburetor put in. If it doesn't work, you know, you drive the car to the shop and you leave it there for a 28-day rehab or whatever, and you drive it out, and if you have any problems problems at all, then the whole thing is a failure. Well, in fact, it's very tough to change behavior in a 28-day period. What you're talking about is getting through the chemical addiction. But much more important is you're talking about reconnecting to life and finding a way to construct a meaningful life pattern that doesn't rely on alcohol and drugs to numb the individual.
One of the hallmarks of drug addiction is that treatment rarely works or is very difficult unless the addict himself or herself wants the help. Have you found that as you look at programs at work that that's been an important ingredient?
Well, that certainly is the received wisdom, Marty, that, you know, you can't get well until you're ready to get well. I mean, the notion that you have to overcome denial, and I think that's all true. But what we have also discovered in the last few years is there are a lot of different kinds of incentives that can push people into getting into treatment and staying there. For example, in the workplace, many large companies now require drug testing. And if you test positive, then you're required to get treatment. And if you can't stick with treatment, or if you come back out of treatment and you continue to test positive, your job is often in jeopardy. Now, what's happened in many cases is that those people who know that their jobs are at stake and they can get good treatment are then able actually to give up drugs and alcohol.
Let's talk about an addict. Let's say they want to get treatment. They've had some problems with the law. They haven't been incarcerated quite yet. What's the chance that an addict on the streets of New York or Washington or Philadelphia can get treatment?
Terrible. It's truly heartbreaking, especially in the largest cities. Here in New York, for example, there are an estimated 250,000 heroin addicts and probably another 300,000 cocaine addicts. And there are only 40,000 drug treatment slots in New York City. And 30,000 of that 40,000 are dedicated to methadone, which means that only heroin addicts who want to get onto methadone can use them. So it gives you a little sense of how squeezed the situation is. The other point is that we need to make treatment more user-friendly. I mean, that is, for example, mothers who are addicts who have young children. They're often single parents. We'll have to give those children into foster care before they can go into treatment. Well, many women are unwilling to do that, no matter how disrupted their lives are, because they're afraid they'll never get their kids back, and that's not an unrealistic fear. There are very few programs still for pregnant addicts. We need to begin to understand that if we are going to have an impact on drug addiction, we have to make treatment readily available. That means almost in the day that I decide I can't stand my life anymore, I need to get treatment, that day I should be into a treatment program. And if I have a 2-year-old kid that I'm responsible for, there should be some way of dealing with that child care requirement instantly. Otherwise, you know, the reason for all this, I mean, I'd like to think it's purely humanitarian, but the real truth is practical. We are now, Dick Darman, who was President Bush's head of the Office of Management and Budget, told Congress last year that drug abuse is now costing us $300 billion a year in lost productivity, accidents, health care claims, drug crime, you know, 300,000 drug-affected babies born every year. The AIDS virus is being transmitted most rapidly in this country through drug abuse. I mean, the costs go on and on. Most of your listeners probably could recite another 15. But the point is that we aren't really addressing it in a way that's going to improve any of these problems.
The remedies you suggest are really all focused at the local level, whether it's in neighborhoods, whether it's in schools, whether it's in businesses. What role do you think then the federal government plays in drug policy?
Leadership. I mean, that is the single most important thing the federal government should be doing. They should be providing a clear message about what we know, about what works and what doesn't. It is because of the federal role that for the last 12 years, we've put more than 3/4 of our resources into trying to reduce supplies. That's why right now schools are basically trying to pick out prevention curricula where they have no guidance at all about which ones have been tested, which ones work better, which, you know, I mean, school administrators are doing their best out there, but by golly, they don't have a consumer's union report which tells them what they should be buying. And the Department of Education in the past has refused to take a position on any of these. They've said it's a free market choice. Well, the free market doesn't work unless you have really readily accessible, adequate information.
We don't have, or nor do we aspire to, an alcohol-free America. What makes you think we can have a drug-free America?
Well, I have to confess that that was the publisher's title, not mine. But well, I do think we can make an enormous dent in the present problem. Drug addiction is now worse than it's ever been in our history. And we have less treatment, less resource to deal with it. I think that we should give this a real try. We have enough flexibility within our current laws to change our focus, to understand that supply control, law enforcement cannot be the sole response. You see, that's been the big problem in the last 12 years, is that the policy has become so polarized. Richard Nixon, back in the 60s, who really talked tough against drugs, in fact put 2/3 of the federal drug budget into treatment. And in those days, treatment was available on demand. I mean, it's only been, so I'm suggesting that it's not a partisan issue. It's just in the last 12 years that the policy has become so extraordinarily focused on one side of the equation. And the costs have been terrible.
Well, I thank you, Mathia Falco, for joining us today on Fresh Air. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, Marty. I enjoyed it.
Mathia Falco is the author of The Making of a Drug-Free America. This is Fresh Air.